Bonsoir. Good evening. Welcome everyone to this special seminar event, Energy Revolution, more like a crawl, by distinguished speaker Václav Smil. It's wonderful to see such a nice turnout. I know we have here in the audience representatives from just about every university campus in Montreal. So from Concordia University, the HEC, Polytechnique, Université de Montréal, and UQAM. So thank you all for showing up. So I'm Subhashish Ghoshal. I'm a professor in McGill's Faculty of Engineering and director of the Trottier Institute for Sustainability in Engineering and Design, which we call TISED in short. And tonight's event is part of the Fondacio 3E speaker program and is co-hosted with TISED. So a bit of background here on Fondacio 3E and the collaboration with TISED. McGill's partnership with Fondacio 3E began about 5 years ago. Looking back, I'm very pleased to say that this relationship has grown over the years and has directly supported TISED's own mission. We at TISED share Fondacio 3E's core beliefs that energy literacy is a pillar of sustainable engineering, that integrative and collaborative design work of engineers, architects, and urban planners is required to reduce energy consumption in the urban envelope, and the transition to non-emitting energy sources is a very important task at hand. Members of the board of Fondacio 3E are here with us today, and I extend them a warm welcome on behalf of TISED. And I would now like to introduce Mr. Michel Gelina, the president of Fondacio 3E. Mr. Gelina obtained a master's from HEC Montreal. His passion for energy issues traces back to a 1980s diplomatic assignment in Trinidad and Tobago, who's obviously oil and gas producer and exporter. And since 2004, Michel has been an analyst and advisor on energy issues. Michel has worked for foreign affairs and various other government departments with a particular focus on energy, infrastructure, and technology issues. I'd like now to invite Michel to the stage to say a few words, please.
Thank you very much, Subhashish. Well, on behalf of the Board of Directors of Fondation 3E, I would like to extend our special thanks to all students that are with us tonight, in particular those of Sci 546. So we place much hope on your shoulders, I must say. Like I said, we believe that sustainability must be engineered and that it applies to both the demand and the supply side of energy and material consumption. We're more focused on the demand side. The question is, could we reduce our absolute energy consumption? We believe that it can be done, and our beliefs are basically of three, they're anchored on three sub-beliefs, if I may say so. One, we cannot manage what we cannot frame and understand, hence our singular focus on energy literacy and energy numeracy. Two, working as a team, energy literate engineers, urban planners, and architects can design and erect environments that will dramatically reduce the absolute energy footprint of the inhabitants. And three, the transition to non-emitting energy sources is desirable, and the contribution of passive as well as opportunistic energy sources should be earnest. Our guest speaker here tonight, whom I had the privilege of meeting nearly 10 years ago, greatly influenced our thinking at Fondation 3E. His book, Energy at a Crossroad, in particular. I recall at the time, being half an economist, I had a chance to review a criticism or review of that book by Mr. Gordon in the Energy Journal. Gordon gave a very favorable review of your book, Václav, and at the end he noted he had this view that, well, however, Mr. Smil is a bit of his views of energy future and the future of energy is a bit idiosyncratic because it is based on this assumption that we should be using less energy. Well, let me hasten to say that we disagree with Gordon and we agree with Václav. So, with this, I would like to ask you to introduce Václav more formally.
Thank you. So, it is indeed my privilege to introduce Václav Smil, a distinguished professor emeritus at the University of Manitoba, a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Václav Smil is a distinguished interdisciplinary researcher and author in areas spanning energy, environment, population dynamics, technical innovation, risk assessment, policy, and probably more. Professor Smil has been listed by the Foreign Policy magazine as among the top 100 global thinkers. Professor Smil was made a member of the Order of Canada for contributions to understanding the impact of energy use on our biosphere. And this year, he received the OPEC Research Award for outstanding work in oil and energy research. It's wonderful to have you finally in Montreal, Václav, and we're honored to have you here with us today. So I invite you to come to the podium for your talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm humbled by so many people willing to spend late Tuesday afternoon, early evening by listening to an old-fashioned professor without PowerPoint. I don't even have a cell phone. We can do it in many ways. I myself usually don't know what I will say in the next 5 or 10 minutes. I like, you know, to do it like that. We can make it very structured, but we'll see how it will go. I'll see how you will react. But anyway, I want to leave you with at least sort of 5 pedagogical didactic messages to take away. Number one, we are a fossil fuel civilization. Right? One more. We are a fossil fuel civilization. Number two, we shall remain so for a long time to come. Because number three, energy transitions take a great deal of time. Right? Because number four, scale matters. Number five, so does power density. Number six, can go on, but at least a couple more. Number six, it's always better to use energy rationally than to come up with new ways how to use it. Right? We are doing exactly the opposite. Right? Number seven, innovation is an overvalued, exaggerated item because when you actually think of it, we are still living in the world of 1880s. You think I'm crazy, but I will show you in a while that it is so. Okay, let's take them one by one and let's lock some numbers in. Numbers are absolutely essential. So I will just throw, you know, great many numbers. If I get one wrong, just correct me. I'm told this is an extraordinary, numerate, scientifically literate, energy advanced class. So I'm ready to stand corrected. Okay. Quarter century is enough time, 25 years, you know, one generation, to get things moving. Right? Things usually should change substantially. 5 years, not enough, 10 years, but 25 years. So 25 years ago, 1990, does somebody have an idea what percentage of global primary energy supply in 1990 came from fossil fuels to the nearest percent? 90. Okay. In 1990, 90% of the planet's primary energy, all fuels and primary electricity, hydro, nuclear, wind, solar, whatever, 90%. What percentage of global energy supply will come from fossil fuels this year? 87. Okay. So in 25 years, we traveled 3%. This renewable route. So you look at the 13%. What is that 13% composed of? What is the single largest chunk of the non-fossil fuels? Clear? 7%. I think they switched it off. So close to 7% is nuclear this year, right? What is the second largest chunk of non-fossil thing? It's hydro, right? What is what I call the new renewables, right? Because hydro and wood and straw, still burn lots of it in China, in Ethiopia. That's old renewables, right? Biomass or biomass fuels and hydro. But when I call the new renewables, there is basically two big items only, right? That's wind and solar, and in terms of fuels, is the modern biofuels, ethanol, biodiesel. All of these new renewables are this year about 2.5% of global primary energy supply. 2.5%, right? Of which big chunk is biofuels, which, as you know, are totally artificial creation in the United States created by the mandates of U.S. Congress. One-third of U.S. corn now goes into making ethanol. One-third of U.S. farmland devoted to corn is eroding and putting all that nitrate into the Gulf of Mexico, so we could put few percent into gasoline cars. I'll get into cars later, but, you know, it's all insane, actually. So suppose, you know, in the next 35 years we'll double it, right? We'll increase the new renewables from what they are now, 2.5%. So in the next 35 years, they'll become 5%. Suppose we'll just massively up everything, right? Subsidize like crazy, force people to do it. We would triple the rate of introduction of new renewables. We'll be at 7.5% or 8%, really, right? So you see the point, right? I decided to look into it in some detail because history is always the best guide. And a few years ago, I wrote this book about energy transitions. Nothing else but quantitative detail look at energy transitions globally and in all major countries, US, USSR, Russia, China, France, UK, Japan. Okay? And the globally, see, individually, you can do in small nations, you can move very rapidly. Dutch golden age, 17th century, running on peat. Then the good peat runs out. They start importing some coal, you know. They have still a little bit of wind from windmills. And then they return to the coal, Limburg. So they've been a major coal miners, coal producers. But then they discover Groningen field. And basically they shut down their coal in a decade, right? So in one nation, you can do a rapid energy transition. In small nation, in a big nation, you cannot do it. Right? In China, basically, is a coal country. Always has been, always will be, I mean, always, for long foreseeable future. So China cannot do what Dutch did in 1960s, right? U.S. cannot do what French did with nuclear power plants in 1970s and 1980s. But you look at it globally, and actually the transitions are getting more difficult. When we move from wood, which was the number one energizer of everything, see, people have this idea, right, that 18th century, this is this kind of, you know, the half-learned history, 18th century was the century of wood, and 19th century was the century of coal, all these steam engines, so-called industrial revolution, which really never happened, but that's another story. And 20th century was the century of oil. All wrong except for the first one, right? 18th century was the century of wood, but so was the 19th century. 19th century, most of the stuff for most of the countries in the world was wood, wood, wood. If you look at the tipping points, we have many good historical statistics, except for England. England tipped from wood to coal by about 1640, right? But when did France tip 50% coal, 50% oil, 50% wood? About 1870, right? At the time of the Great Defeat, France became finally the coal country, 1870. When did the U.S. flip? Sooner or later? Well, naturally later, because there's much more wood to burn than France, right? But 1884, up to 1884, most of the American energy, right, was coming from wood. Only from 1884 on was coal, right? Japan flipped about 1901, and Russia flipped about 1925, 1930, right? And China flipped only about 1965, 1970, right? So, you know, until recently, we've been still at biomass, wood and straw-fueled countries and continents and civilization. So anyway, going from wood to coal, I had to choose something. I chose not arbitrarily, but, you know, 5%. If you reach 5% of the market, you matter. 1% of the market, nobody notices you. But 5%, 1 out of 20, that's a pretty good thing. So I look, you reach 5% of the market, right? And by the time you get to 25%, you become a king of the market, right? Because there are very few items which go like 90%, right? There will never be a global market where one source of energy will be 90%, right? So going from 5% to 25%, from biomass to coal, it took us 35 years globally. Going from 5% of oil to 25% of oil took us 40 years. Going from 5% of natural gas to 25% of natural gas has taken us 55 years, right? So it's taking us longer and longer, but it's obvious. Why? Because the base is getting larger, right? Scale is increasing, right? So, you know, to shove it extra 5% in 18, 550, you know, was 10 million tons. To shove extra 5% now is half a billion tons, right? So scale is getting larger, so that's one simple physical part of it. But the techniques and the fuels themselves are getting trickier. You get coal. Everything you do is wood. You could do with coal, only better. The fuel has higher density, right? Air-dry wood, it's about 17, depends what kind of wood it is, 15, 16, 17, 18 gigajoules per ton, right? Very good coal, and we start with some very good coal in 19th century. It's 28, 29, 30 gigajoules per ton. So almost twice the energy density, right? So when you use coal to replace wood, it's easy, right? It's perfect, right? You go into oil, and the energy density is there, right? A ton of oil is 42 gigajoules. Compared to ton of average bituminous coal you burn in power plant, it's about 24, 22 kilos. So you get almost twice as much energy density, or twice as much energy actually in oil than coal. And on top of it, of course, is a portable fuel, so you can, you know, run the planes and trains and cars with it. So it seems to be great. However, it's not so great because the distribution is tricky, right? You know, there are most countries in the world don't have it, right? We have about 200 countries in the world today, and of them 160 are importers of it, right? So we have to import it from somewhere. So if you don't have the foreign exchange, it's not so easy to import it. And it requires some sophistication of use. You could burn it, right, like you burn coal in the open, but that's, heck, you know, that's polluting. So you have to have sophisticated machine for it, internal combustion engine, gas turbine, right? And these things are energy intensive, knowledge intensive, take a while to produce them. So by the time you get to have a billion cars, well, you know, you don't get a billion cars. When you start with Fort Martley in October 1908, it takes you about a century to get your billion cars, right? So to convert that easy fuel, really. So the scale is getting larger, and requirements, technical requirements, are getting more sophisticated. One of the most sophisticated machines in modern civilization is the machine which flew me here today, right? And that's a gas turbine, right? For those of you who don't know, we can take exactly the gas turbine which flew me here, and we can put it on the ground, right, and just use it to generate electricity. Not quite, do a little bit modification, right, but it's the same thing. So gas turbine stationary, gas turbine flights, that's a very sophisticated machine. Extremely low failure rate, 0.0001%. But, you know, there are only five companies in the world who can really make it, the big one, right? You know, it's only Rolls-Royce and GE and CFM and Pratt & Whitney. There are not many people can tell you. So you cannot simply say, I want to convert. Suppose I have infinite amount of natural gas right now, right? But I have to convert it using gas turbines, right? I cannot say, let's have 10 gigawatts of gas turbines per week. I cannot. There's only five manufacturers to make it, really, right? You know, so it's very limited, these things. So when you get into more sophisticated conversions, many limits get in, and this is why it takes longer. Probably natural gas will not hit 33%, despite of having, you know, lots of it very cheap. Probably will not hit 33% for another 10, 15 years, really, right? So no matter what transition you look at, it's always decades, 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 just to go from 5 to 25. Oil, actually, coal, of course, at one point was like, you know, very high, like 80, 90, in some countries, basically 100%. This will never be repeated. Oil went way above 40%, but then with the double increase of prices by OPEC in 1970s, oil has started to decline. And right now, it's about 33%, and we are globally. We are now in a very strange position globally right now, that oil is 33% and falling, although the low prices now will probably bump it up a little bit. Coal is at 30% and rising. Coal actually has been rising most. The fastest increase in past 20 years hasn't been natural gas in terms of total energy base, but it's coal. Because, you know, 25 years ago, Chinese are mining 1 billion tons. Now Chinese are mining almost 4 billion tons. You know? So this has been the single largest increase in past 30 years. It hasn't been wind or solar or nuclear. It's been coal, 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 right? So still this is very much a, for China, very much a coal fuel century. So we have gas at 25 and rising, coal at 30 and kind of, you know, rising but almost steady, and oil at 33 and falling. So for the first time in history, we have these three fossil fuels almost at the same level, about close to 30%, really, right? And what's interesting, because we invested so much into each of them, that it's to a very large extent embedded. It's changing all the time, but very slowly. So let's say right now, in U.S. people say, oh, the U.S. coal-fired power plants are going out today, right, because there is cheap natural gas. It's not so much because of cheap natural gas, it's simply so much because of the age of these coal-fired power plants, right? American coal-fired power plants simply exploded in the 1950s because electricity consumption was increasing by 10% a year, 7, 8% a year. So we built electric, these giant, you know, 200, 300, and 500, 800 megawatt plants, gigawatt plants, everywhere in 50s and 60s. Well, you add it up, 50s and 60s right now, well, they are old, right? 40, 50, 55 years, so they are naturally closing down. And when you close it down, you put a gas turbine or combined cycle gas turbine or whatever you have. Right? So it's a natural process. But look at China, right? When people talk, okay, we can do this differently this time. You know, we are so smart, we are so high-tech. By the way, this irks me no end, that we took a perfectly nice word, which should be actually, it's better in France, in French, you know, la technique. And we took the word la technique and make a technology out of it, which is kind of a bird word, because technology is a science about technique, really, right? Okay. And we took the word technology and shrank it to stupid computers only, really, right? Like a gas turbine is not technique, right? Everything is technique, really, right? You know, wheel is a technique, really, right? You know? So anyway, people say, now it's different. We have Silicon Valley, we are electronic, we are sophisticated, artificial intelligence, no boundaries given. We can transit from this to that in no time, right? The old truths don't apply, right? Absolute hogwash, absolute hogwash. Look at China, okay? Look at first at these big Western countries like France, Germany, UK. Each of these three countries, Germany is bigger, right? Germany is 80 million people, these others are about 60 plus. So they have, let's say, on the order of 60 gigawatts, okay? Total installed capacity in these countries, right? Took them 100 years to get there, right? China, in 2005, 2006, 2007, you see the point, right? Every year was installing 60 gigawatts, every year, per year, and 80% of it coal, 80% of it coal, right? So imagine the Chinese pumping it, you know, 40 gigawatts of coal 1 year, 40 gigawatts next year, 50 gigawatts next year, and that was done a few years ago. Are they going to walk away from this when a single power plant is what? Does somebody have an idea what a power plant of, let's say, 1.5 gigawatt is? Even in China. What about $1.5 billion, right? Okay, so you don't walk away from $1.5 billion which you put in place in 2008 just because somebody says the world should be green, right? And we should transit to beautiful solar, right? So China got itself into this embedded situation where 80%, close to 80% of electricity is in coal and in brand new coal-fired power plants which have to be amortized over the next 35, 40 years, whatever, right? China is now easing out finally after this rush, you know, this rapid growth of the past 20 years. China is, everything is easing out, China. Economic growth, electricity consumption, coal consumption is finally coming down this year, right? I mean, no, not like that, but a little bit. But who's coming to fill the gap? India. India is now doing exactly the same thing which China was doing, building massive coal-fired power plants right, left, and center as fast as they can. Why? Because it's the only fuel which they domestically have. India is not sitting on a bubble of natural gas. India is not bursting with crude oil, right? You know? So it's cheaper now. They can import it, but still, the best thing is what you have. Except there is one big difference between Indian coal and Chinese coal. Chinese coal, whatever you say about it, it's a good, good bituminous coal. Unlike German coal, which is lousy lignite, right, the brown coal, Chinese coal is a good bituminous coal. What is the Indian coal? Well, you hesitate to call it coal. About 40% of it is ash, right? You know, 30, 35, 40%. Which means to generate one useful kilowatt hour, you've got to burn so much more of that junk, really, right? And you've got to catch so much more fly ash. And fortunately, Indian coal is not terribly high in sulfur, otherwise you have to desulfurize another whatever, $100 million per plant or whatever like crazy. So these are the embedded things, and countries will do them because that's the only thing they do, really. And unfortunately, these two big countries, where most of the global economic growth has come from, in China, and will come from India, are the coal countries, and they have no other choice, right? So, you know, to just project some graphs, whatever, what will happen, you know, that's neither here nor there. Reality is what matters. Then you look closer at the scale of oil, because oil, of course, has given us something which we never had before, and it's the mobility. It's because it's the densest of all normal fuels. The only denser fuel is what than oil? one is to liquid hydrogen, really. But to make hydrogen liquid, you know, this is no fun, really, right? So oil is the king and will remain king because we want to be mobile. People are mobile to the level which people didn't even realize that 20 years ago. I grew up in Europe. When I grew up in Europe as a little kid, I mean, flying was something like, you know, that was from movies, right? You know, when I left Europe in 1969, maybe like 2 people out of 100 ever flown in their life, right? Even in late 70s, very few people. If you were a German businessman in 1975, and you took a trip from Köln to Munich, naturally you jump on a train, right? Now you know where the story ends, right? Every bus in EU has a side panel which says 20 euro flight from Amsterdam to Cyprus, right? For 20 euro, right? Europeans are now flying more per capita than Americans, right? For 20 euro, right? And Europeans have most of these mad connections. You know, in North America, we still have the hub system, right? So if I want to fly somewhere, I have to fly to Vancouver or Toronto from Winnipeg, right? Now, in Europe, we have these connections from Riga in Latvia to Zagreb, right? We have Aberdeen to Thessaloniki, right? I mean, it's just crazy. Europe is, and all these, this kind of, by the way, you may have noticed that last year, a famous discounter let that airline be unnamed, patented the proposal for standing room only, holding the strap, right? So, I mean, it will cost probably €1, right? From €1 from Amsterdam to Sicily, right? For €1. And this is all subscribed by what? You know, friends of mine, we have many friends, you know, in Europe. They don't think twice, you know, they go over the weekend, they fly from you know, from wherever, you know, from Holland to Cyprus for a weekend, right? And for bigger vacation, they are constantly, half of Germany is constantly in Thailand, in Australia, right? Or, you know, walking in Alaskan wilderness, right? Okay? Now, you haven't seen anything yet because now Chinese are starting to travel. By year 2020, EU will expect 200 million Chinese tourists, right? Okay? I mean, you know, they're already coming, right? You can see them already in Paris, and they will not come to Europe. They will come to 6 big cities, basically, right? You know, so if you haven't seen your Venice or Paris or London, do it now because, you know, we have only about, like, you know, shrinking, right? 200 million of them, right? And we are talking about only so-called middle class, right? There is another 1.1 billion of them, right? There's 1.35 billion, right? So, you know, if Chinese would travel like Japanese, right, then you couldn't move in European cities, right? And this is all subscribed by crude oil. True, we are getting more efficient, really, right? But, you know, even this most efficient, even beautiful new 787, it still sucks quite a bit, really, right? It's 15% less than 777, which was 15% less than whatever, but still, you know, it's crude oil. Now, this is what people who usually retail these wholesale sagas of wind and solar taking over tomorrow, they don't tell us how we will fly. Solar electricity is not quite conducive to flying. Haven't you noticed that, really, right? You know, do I put my panels on? Oh, yes, we can put the panels on the, and what? It can carry what? One man, right? Lying like that, really, you know, fearing for the life at the speed of a mouse, or a little moth flying across, you know. So, nor can you fly on natural gas, really, nor can you fly on wind electricity. So we have this fundamental problem. Globally now, it's pushing above 30%. More than every third unit of energy we use now is to go somewhere, really, right? You know, in the airport today in Toronto, I just saw this latest Infiniti SQ8 or something like that. It's like a massive, it's bigger than Humvee, right? I mean, it's just unbelievable, right? We are creating cars. You see, I used to buy always Honda Accord for ages. Then I stopped buying Honda Accord because my new Honda Civic is longer, wider, bigger, and heavier than Honda Accord, right? Even the Japanese cars have increased by about 50% in their mass over the past 25 years. And you know what happened to average European car, right? What was the average European car? The Chevy, 650 kilo, right? What is now average European car? 1,400 kilo, right? What is the average American car? 1,750 kilo, right? And of course, there are these other things, like these SUVs, like Escalade. You can walk past of it, right, for about 5 minutes, right? You know, that's the size of Escalade. That's about 3 tons, really, right? Okay. So notice that thing, too. We are making engines which are more fuel efficient, but putting them into vehicles which are much more massive, which totally negates all that thing, really, right? Okay. And then you have to think about embedded energy, right? What will a car small to make? Of course, the heavier car will cost more to make, because not only will it contain more steel, but we are putting more high energy materials into it, right? The substitution of materials has gone only one way, toward higher embedded energy materials. 1 kilogram of perfectly fine steel, really high quality specific steel, you know, we have like 20,000 steel, so you select the best one, whatever your chromium, vanadium specification, and you can make it for about 30 megajoules, right? 30 gigajoules per ton. What is 1 ton of aluminum, if I replace that aluminum to make it lighter, right? What is 1 ton of aluminum? Close to 200 gigajoules, right? Instead of 35 gigajoules, right? I replace it by plastic, right? To make it lighter, that steel is bad. What is one ton of plastic? Your average, whatever it is, you know, there's a zillion. Well, anywhere between 80 to 140 gigajoules per ton. So I'm tripling, quadrupling the cost again. Everything which I do to make it lighter, more efficient, embeds more energy into it, right? And forget about the fact now about, you know, that about one-third of the value of American car now is electronics, right? There are so many microchips in your car, you have no idea, right? I will not tell you the secret. You will go and find out for yourself what is the energy required to make 1 ton of silicon, electronic quality silicon, right? You'll be surprised. It's an order of magnitude. It's not gigajoules per ton, okay? Just you'll find for yourself. So what we are doing, you know, we are constantly moving in the direction of more energy-intensive materials. The same with 787 I mentioned a while, right? Composite fibers, right? Composite fiber will not cost you as much as steel, right? Look at the cars, it's through the window, really, right? Okay. Or you can play with titanium, same story, right? It's about eight times as much, whatever. So it's not only the cost of what you pour in or put in, it's the cost of what you embed in. And while I'm on this, this applies to all these new renewable conversions. You go to Europe and there are wind turbines everywhere, right? Denmark, Sweden, Germany, everywhere are wind turbines. Mind you, most of them, most of the time, are not turning, right? You know it. Why? This is a very engineering-minded class. So what is the typical load factor, a capacity factor of my run-of-the-mill coal-fired power plant, which I built in, as I say, in U.S. or Saskatchewan or Alberta by dozens? What is the typical load factor of the power plant? That is, what percentage of time a year it operates? Well, I have to conk it off for scheduled maintenance and something may happen. But I can get easily 75% out of it, no problem. Chinese get 90% out of it in shortages, right? You know, what is the capacity factor for nuclear power plants? Actually, this country happens to be a leader. We haven't built a nuclear power plant for ages, really, but the ones which we have, we now operate them what? 95% of the time, 92.5, 93, 95. That's the capacity factor. What is the capacity factor of average European wind turbine? 25. What is the capacity of average American wind turbine? A little bit more windy, right, on the place. 30%, right? 30%. So 70% doesn't do anything. 75% doesn't do anything, really. So whenever I fly from Europe, you look and you know, these monsters are so big, even from the jetliner, you see if they are turning or not turning, really, right? And it's always amazing how many are not turning when I fly across Switzerland or France or whatever, right? But anyway, people say, this is the great future. I look at these monsters, and they are monsters, right? You know, the blade is bigger than Boeing 747, really. I mean, you know, you see them from airplane, they, you know. Well, what are these monsters made of? So you look at these things and you see green, probably, you know, whatever, Elizabeth May or Thomas Mulcair, our next prime minister. I'm not commenting. See that this is the green future. What do I see as an old-fashioned, stupid scientist? I see the big trucks needed to bring these 80-meter blades to the site, right? Giant diesel trucks to fetch it up to the top of that mountain, right? First, I have these bulldozers, the graders, grading the road to make it accessible and firming the road so these trucks wouldn't collapse into it, right? This is all diesel fuel going all the way, right? There is giant trucks built into the place, right? What are these big blades, right? Plastic, 120 gigajoules per ton. What is the foundation? Concrete. How do you make concrete? You fire lots of coal in the big furnace and turn the clay around there, right? Then you have to do the big steel stem, because it cannot, you know, you cannot put it on wood because in the first wind it would just be ripped off. So I look at this and I see concrete and steel and diesel fuel and plastics. I don't see any renewable energy there, really, right? And these things will last what? maybe 15, 20 years, right? And then we'll do it one with them. How will you recycle all these things, right? Which is already in Europe. This is called repowering, because they came this first wave, subsidized wave in Europe in 90s and early 2000. And they put these dinky little turbines, like, you know, 200, 300, 500. Right? Now they are putting what? 2 megawatts, 3 megawatts, right? So they repower. They just, after just 10 years of the service, they just simply shut down all these 200, 300, and they put now, they are putting up to what, 3, 4 megawatt, or 5 megawatt units, right? So, while if I built my power plant, as I said, we are closing down, they closed down a few years ago, one in Iowa, which was working since 1924, really, right? You know, boiler is an extremely durable thing, really, right? Engine is nuclear power plants. Most of our nuclear power plants are recertified, and they'll be eventually, before they die, they'll be working for what? 50, 60 years, today, right? You know, I guarantee you that not a single wind turbine will work for 60 years. Absolutely guarantee you that, right? Not a single photovoltaic cell out there will work 60 years, right? Because what will happen to them, especially in ideal places, ideal place being what? Of course, Sahara, all these stories, right? They'll get pitted mercilessly by all that sand blown against them. By the way, this shows you the famous, you know, this German engineering, you know, Vorsprung durch Technik, as Audi says, right? So Siemens, of all people, Siemens just made a few years ago, they made a study saying, you know, because what is the number one solar power in Europe and indeed in the world now next to China? It's Germany, right? Germany is about as sunny as Seattle, right? So imagine you make the engineering choice, you know, a place which is as sunny as Washington State to be the hub of the solar energy in Europe, right? So Siemens looked back, and they did that study a few years ago saying, you know, if you would have put all of that capacity which you put in German solar, you would put into Spain and Italy and built even additional high voltage lines, you would have saved $40 billion. I would have told them that when I was like 10 years old, right, kind of, right? Because I grew up in that part of the world, right? And I remember as if today, when they called me, when Germany started the Energiewende, right, this big energy change, right, shortly after 2000. And this phone call from New York Times, 2000, whatever, one, two, three. And they say, could you comment on the world's largest photovoltaic plant? I said, I would if I would know where it is. They said, few kilometers from Nuremberg, right? I said, come again, because I grew up about 50 kilometers from that place. And they always say, we as children, we didn't want to have summer vacation, because, you know, this is not far from Atlantic and North Sea, and these frontal systems come every 3 days, and everything is cloudy, right? And it rains every 3 days. So if you look at the sky, cirrus cloud. That means, you know, there'll be a cumulus cloud tomorrow, right? And heavy rain the day after, right? So in one of the most, well, what do I say? It's Seattle, right? Go to Seattle and see how Seattle is sunny. So they've been putting solar. So what is the average load factor of German solar? 11%, 12%. And you are spending billions of dollars and telling you this is the green future, you know? Even in Spain, what would you think is the Spanish load factor in Spain? 16%, 16, 17%, right? Now, the Arizona things are getting better. In Arizona, you can get 25%, right? But the biggest one in Arizona, biggest one in Southwest U.S. now is the, you know that one? Nobody knows the name? Ivanpah, right? Ivanpah actually failed in the first year. Why? Because this shows the limits of our capacity to manage these things. We are now very good with wind and solar to tell you the next day. It will shine or it will not. It will blow or it will not, right? So day forecast, 2 day forecast, good. So you can manage your load kind of, you know, for next 2, 3 days. But we are not at all good in an annual basis. And this year is proving up really funny, right? Kind of the pre-El Nino year. Capacity of wind in U.S. will be up by 6% or whatever, but the production will be down by about 30%. Why? Because this year is a very still year, right? There is much less wind on an annual basis than before. And same happened in Ivanpah. They start the biggest solar plant in U.S., and it's just not generating because it was much more cloudy, actually, right? So, you see, this is the thing that this is just give you a little taste of it, what we are up to. It has engineering solution, but it's tricky. With all of these intermittent sources, where the predictions are possible on a daily basis, but impossible on seasonal basis, and utterly impossible on annual basis, you've got to make sure that what? You have a huge amount of reserve capacity in place. Otherwise, you burn, right? Okay? So you can have this situation, like where I live, right? This is the most idle. We are, most people don't know, People associate Winnipeg only with mosquitoes and unbearable winters, but that's not true. We have no mosquitoes, basically, and winters are quite bearable, much better than Montreal, you know, or in Ottawa, right? There's nothing worse than minus 2 Celsius and 100% humidity, right? And so, anyway, we, for our size, about 700,000 people, we are the windy city on the planet, right? Because we are the end story of that, between from Gulf of Mexico all the way to the plains, right? So we are very windy, right? So it's an ideal place to put wind turbines, right? So Manitoba Hydro, I don't know why they put some wind turbine, they subcontracted. They don't need it because we are 100% hydro, but they wanted to be politically correct, so they put some wind turbines through, right? So we are the super windy place, but when do we need that electricity most? Well, of course, in January, right, when it's cold and dark and ugly outside, right? And why is it cold? You know, if only all these people would study kindergarten climate science, really. Well, it's cold because there is so-called Canadian High. What Canadian High does? Well, it's simply skies are blue, you know, the high air presses down, and there is not a bit of wind for 3 weeks, and our daily high are below our normal overnight lows, okay? So our daily high is, let's say, minus 15, overnight or minus 25, but for 3 weeks, our daily high may be minus 30, right? And there is no wind at all, right? So what do I do, right, when 1 million people need this juice? Well, so I have to have some other form, right? So I have to install equal capacity in gas turbines, really, right, for these 3 weeks when I have nothing, really. Or I have to have massive interconnections to buy from somebody else. Do we have in Canada any interconnections going from east to west? No, not a single one. You cannot send a kilowatt hour east to west, really, right? In the U.S., all we do, the one in Texas is about 250 megawatts, which is a joke, really, right? You know, U.S. and Canada have none of this. We have this, right? Manitoba says all the way to Nebraska, right? Quebec says all the way to, right, New York, right? B.C. says all the way to California, right? But nobody is selling this way, really, right? Europe is different. Europeans are selling electricity like we are selling marijuana in this country, right? Everywhere, right? Everybody's selling to everybody else, right? You look at the statistics, right? It's very interconnected, right? Switzerland is the best case. You look at the Swiss electricity statistics. They generate X, and they sell X plus 20, and they buy X plus 10. It's just constantly moving in and out because they are hub. They are basically storage up in the middle. So Europeans have that capacity, but there is a limit to it. You heard about the Danish miracle. Danes have all these wind turbines, right? You know, when it's windy, they get like 80% of their electricity. We are small. It's a scale matters, right? So they get 80% of their electricity from wind. But when there is no wind, this is a windy place, but still there is no wind. Why Danes could do that? Well, because they can get the cheap hydro from Norway, or they can get that coal or nuclear from Germany, right? Where is my Norway in Manitoba? Where is my, you know, German coal in Manitoba, right? Not in Nebraska, right? So if I go green, solar and wind in Manitoba, I have to have a huge reserve capacity for up to 3 weeks, right? And as you know, most of you being of engineering background, we do not have any storage on that scale. Look, this is very simple. We shouldn't even be talking about energy problem as soon as you give me a gigawatt scale storage for a reasonable price, right? Okay? Then it doesn't matter what capacity my solar is. I could have a 5% load factor of my solar. But as long as it's working a little bit and stuffing all that electricity into my gigawatt storage, I don't care really, right? You know, I could have wind blowing only here and there. But as long as it's putting that storage in, so are we any closer to gigawatt scale storage today than we were 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago? Answer is no, of course, we are not. There are certain physical limits for good reason. Some things do not happen. This idea that innovation can solve every problem, not so. Actually, innovation hasn't solved most of the fundamental problems. Let me get back to my favorite 1880s before I forget about this. You see, if you would bring the people from 1880s here, people who invented the world which we live in, you know, the world which we live in wasn't invented by Elon Musk. What did Elon Musk invent, I ask you? Can you tell me one thing which Elon Musk invented? American media tells he's the most inventive man, bigger than Edison. What did he invent? He's buying Panasonic batteries from Japan, putting on a plastic cover with a big T on it, right, and sells it to people, right? That's what he, you know, what did he invent, right? And then he gets, because we stopped sending shuttle up, so there's lots of unemployed NASA engineers. He buys them into X company, right? What did he invent, right? So the world we live in wasn't invented by Jobs or Tesla or Elon Musk or none of these people. The world we live in was invented by some young but mostly middle-aged white men in the 1880s. Thomas Alva Edison, William Stanley, George Westinghouse, Nikola Tesla. These people invented electricity generation, steam turbo generator, transformer, electric motor. Without this, nothing would happen. Without this, you couldn't hold your cell phone, right? Without this, you couldn't heat your house. Without this, you couldn't travel on the airplane. Without this, there would be no Western civilization. Internal combustion engine, right? Okay, Daimler, Maybach, Benz, 1884. It's all the 1880s. We've been just simply deriving secondary, tertiary, quaternary derivation from that basis of 1880s, right? So before you tell me how impossibly accelerating innovation is moving us all, you know, I tell you, read your history, right? And learn what is there, right? I was lecturing at one of these Silicon Valley outfits about 10 days ago, and I reminded them that what they are doing really is about the seventh level removed from what really matters. What really matters is what? Is Maxwell. Because Maxwell had this idea, because before Maxwell, nobody had the idea there is something, you cannot touch it, you cannot see it, you don't even know it's there, right? And Maxwell had a brilliant idea that it will be there, right? He didn't have any idea how he could prove it and make it, whatever, but that's it, right? 1860s. Then comes the man who actually makes it, right? Sends a signal from A to B, and that's Hertz, right? So Maxwell is the first level, right? Hertz is the second level, right? Then there are people who make the Hertzian, Maxwellian waves go longer distances, right? If we get into what? Well, if we get into Telegraph Hill, right? If we get into Marconi, right? If we get into radio, if we get into Lee DeForest, right? You create a tube, right? And once you create a vacuum tube, by 1906, 1907, we could have built everything, television, everything. But the war intervened and we didn't, right? So you get from Maxwell to Hertz to sending the signal and making the hot glass electronics, right? And then you get into solid-state electronics, right? Which is not Shockley, Bratt, and Bardeen, because unbeknownst to most of the people, but, you know, eventually it's been recognized, the patent for a solid-state transistor was filed by Lilienfeld in 1924, right? So by 1924, if somebody would have picked it up, we could have made all this, you know? It had to wait after another war, and we made it, right? So that's another level. Then you have to make that transistor into a bunching of something, right? And you can come with integrated circuit, and that's Noyce and Kilby, late 1950s. And then you get lots of the circuits and make them into microprocessor, right? And that's Intel 1970s, really. And once you have the microprocessor, then you can start making your computers and cell phones, right? And then just somebody writes some software for the cell phone, really, right? So you see, that's about the seventh level of derivation. And without these six levels before, none of these things would work, right? So we are basically, you know, it's this beautiful garden, and everything's been, you know, planted and invented in the garden, and we are kind of just brushing some pollen of some flower and smelling it and saying, oh, this smells great, right? Cell phone and whatever, right? But, you know, this is not original at all, you know? It so fundamentally depends on your steam turbine. This is still the number one primer on this planet is a steam turbine, right? It still depends on electric motors. It still depends on all these things. So I'm not all that smitten. It's just simply, you know, it's pictures. And, you know, we are visual creatures, and we are also social creatures, so it's pictures putting us together in touch with other people. That's why we think it's such a fundamental invention. But let me tell you that this civilization could live quite well without cell phones and any computer, actually. What is the single most important invention, talking about technology, in this planet, without which 45% of people would be dead right now? What is it? Haber-Bosch synthesis of ammonia, right? Because there is not enough nitrogen in the global ecosystem. When I take every bit of manure, every bit of human excrement and urine, every bit of straw, and recycle them into the soil, right? These things contain what? Straw, 0.5% of nitrogen, right? Urine, well, it's mostly water. It's a fraction of personality. So if I take all animals, you see how many millions of people have to be employed to recycle all the waste and put in, and still, you would not have enough nitrogen to grow food for about 45% of human population now. And that was the buried which was with us. We tried, you know, a little bit of Chilean nitrate, but, you know, you run out of it soon. A little bit of guano from tropical birds, you run out of it soon. And then comes Fritz Haber. This is a brilliant invention, 1909, synthesizing ammonia from its element. You put it under pressure, high temperature, You take your nitrogen, right, from the air. You take your hydrogen. He took it from hydrogenation of coal. Now we take it from natural gas and create NH3, right? Who is the biggest maker of NH3 on the planet now? Of course, Chinese, right? Because they have no land and they have to fertilize like crazy, right? And then Indians and so I wrote a fat book and lots of articles about this years ago. So in my mind, there is absolutely, you see, before you do anything, you have to be alive, right? You know, all the cell phones and mentioned. And 45% of people on this planet wouldn't be alive, and 70% of Chinese and 60% of Indians, if it wouldn't be for Haber-Bosch synthesis of ammonia. Because your barriers to grow, what is the growth? It's protein, right? What is protein? Amino acids. What is amino acids? Nitrogen. I mean, it's a kindergarten science, but most people apparently don't know kindergarten science these days. So they think the greatest invention is iPhone, right? I mean, what a joke, really, right? You know, iPhone is the greatest invention, right? You know, probably like 98% out of 100 even educated Westerners have no idea about Haber-Bosch synthesis of ammonia, right? Bosch being the guy working for Bass, Bayerische Onion and Soda Fabrik, who made the bench experiment of Haber into an industrial process in just 4 years. Haber was done by in summer 1909, and by October 1913, the factory was running, right? That's what I call applied engineering, right? You know, so these guys today, they get $1 billion of investors' money and venture funds, and still, you know, the company flops. So, you know, there is very little to admire, you know. It's just simply very superficial, but fundamentals. I just finished a book about steel. Let me say a few things about steel. People think that somehow steel kind of, you know, who cares, steel, right? I had to convince my publishers that book about steel is eminently important, not about, you know, microchips or iPhones. We are dependent on steel more than ever in our history, and the dependence is not going to get away. Because literally, and I'm not exaggerating here, everything you can see in this room, nothing would be here without steel, right? How are the fabrics woven? By steel machines. How is everything cut or molded or extruded, right? By steel, saws, punches, presses, everything, right? You know? How do you fly? Okay, you know, the 787 could be lots of composite stuff and lots of aluminum, whatever. But what are the most bearing parts when you dunk on that ground, right? You know, it's steel, right? Without it, steel, you wouldn't land, really, right? You don't want to have your steel, you don't want to have your undercarriage. I mentioned the wind turbines, right? That's steel. How do you put that photovoltaic stuff on your roof? Steel frame, right? To put it on your roof and then put it, right? How do you make steel? Well, you know, you make it from, you can recycle it, of course, and then you go through electric arc furnace. But if you make it de novo, you have to make it from pig iron, right? Cast iron. How do you make pig iron? From coal, because you need coke. 1 billion tons of coal these days goes into making coke. We know of no other large-scale method how to make iron but from coke, right? There is a direct iron reduction, right? We can do that, really. But listen to this. We make now about 1.2 billion tons of pig iron, and we make about 50 million tons of direct reduction iron, right? You see the scale again, really, right? So suppose, you know, if somebody gives you infinite amount of not cheap but free wind or solar electricity, right? How do you make 1.2 billion tons of pig iron, right? I ask you that, right? No? We just cannot make it if it's totally cheap and free electricity, right? How do you fly over the weekend from Holland to, oh, you can say biofuels. Oh, here comes my favorite. Sometimes when I fly to Asia, so I have to go to Vancouver, so you fly over the prairies, and now a few years ago we broke, you know, things change over time. It used to be always wheat, right? Now wheat, it's still important, but sometimes in summer you fly over the prairies and it's what's all yellow, right? Because it's all rapeseed now, right? So we broke the way that in terms of value now, the number one crop on the prairies is not wheat, it's the rapeseed, right? Have you ever seen the size of the rapeseed? Eh? And 20% of that size is oil, right? Now you crush them to make yourself biojet fuel, really, right? Start doing your calculations, which brings me to essential thing about power density, my latest book. Power density is such an all-important concept, yet totally neglected. I mentioned the ethanol. Calculate with me here, right? You know, it would be nice to have a board, but you know, you are highly numerative, so we can calculate all the sub-mag in your head. Okay, calculate with me. In U.S., they mandated ethanol from corn. Corn in U.S., there is no better corn on this planet. The highest yielding. That's why it's called Corn Belt, right? You go to Asia, you get 3 tons per hectare, okay? You go to Europe, maybe you get 6 tons. In Iowa, you get 12 tons per hectare. On the average, 10 tons per hectare, okay? Here you go, 10 tons per hectare. One ton is 15 gigajoules, okay? 10 tons, 150 gigajoules, right? How many harvests of that corn I make a year? One, right? Climate is not good enough, just one. 150 gigajoules, right? So what is the power density of it? Well, I divide by the number of seconds in a year, right? Energy divided by time is power, right? So 150 GJ divided by 3.1 to 10 to 7 seconds, right? Okay? And divided by what? 10, 10, 10, 10, right? Hectare is 100 by 100 meters, right? Okay, you've done the calculation. It's half a watt per square meter, right? Half a watt per square meter I get, half a watt, right? When I go to Saudi Arabia or to Alberta, but if I go to Saudi Arabia and I sink my well, right? And that valley is like, will occupy the, like, you know, half of this room, or like this room, right? What will be the power density of production from that well? 10,000 watts per square meter, okay? So I need only like few thousand wells in the Middle East to do what? To fuel most of the world, right? Here, to fly 1787 to Asia, I have to plant, you can do calculations, hectares and hectares of land in Manitoba every year just to fly there. You can do better than rapeseed. You can go to the most intensive oily stuff on this planet, which is palm oil, which is what? Tropical deforestation, end of the planet as we have known it, right? But it is the high energy density, right? You harvest a lot more palm oil per hectare than rapeseed, right? You can look into my power density book published in June. It would go for palm oil. If you go for ethanol, only in the U.S., 100% ethanol, every acre in the U.S. or every hectare would have to be planted to corn, right? You would have nothing for food, people, no feed for animals, nothing, you know, just... If you go for palm oil, it would be doable to fly on palm oil, providing that you would surrender a large chunk of tropics to palm oil, right? Cut down. So you see, on one hand, we have green people telling us, you know, we have to preserve biodiversity, we have to preserve tropical rainforests. And on the other hand, they are telling us, we will fly on biofuels, right? Just do your calculations, including power densities, and you will see that it's not so easy. Now, if we would be run the system by power density, is the only, not the only, but by far the superior energy is solar. Because you start on the average of 170 watts per square meter of the rotating planet, right? And that's a big chunk. If I can use it with efficiencies are rising, right? If I can use it only with 10% efficiency like now, it's about 20 watts per square meter. If I eventually the efficiency 20%, whatever, I can have 40, 50 watts per square meter. That's a sizable chunk, right? So the best investment, if I would be running the show, not that I want to, but if I would be running the show and ask me where to put my money into, right, I wouldn't put money into sea ducks. You've seen them, right? Moving with the waves, right? Oh, my God, you know. You generate about as much energy to, you know, boil a coffee in half a day. By the way, the big sea ducks company went bankrupt in Scotland, right, last year. It's over, right? So, please, no tidal power, no wave power, I shouldn't say no wind, because some wind is pretty good, really, but above all solar, because if we would get the solar efficiency by hook and crook, and there are different ways out to reach 40%, right? And eventually get there, right? So if you get me a 40% solar efficiency, then if you put it in a place which has 25% capacity factor, like Algeria or Arizona, really, right? And when you make a big plant in a desert where nothing grows anyway, except for that pitting and cleaning, you know, because you've got to clean it basically all the time, because if you don't clean it, the performance will deteriorate, right? But we are talking, really. So this is the by far the greatest potential. But then you have to do what? Where the demand is in U.S., in Canada, east and west, there's nobody in the middle, really, right? I said a while ago, we have no juice lines running from Arizona to New York, right? Or if you go big with the wind in Manitoba or North Dakota, we have no juice lines running to Toronto or Vancouver, right? How much it costs to build 1 kilometer of a high voltage line? Well, it depends where you build it, but you know, if you do it on cheap, about $500,000, but that's very cheap and very rare. Usually it's like $1 million, $1.5 million. It could be $2 million, $3 million, it could be $5 million actually, depending what you do, really. But even that is not important. Suppose it's only $1 million per kilometer, right? But what's more important than what? is the NIMBY comes in, right? Nobody wants to have giant voltage line in the backyard. So it will take you with average voltage line about 10 years of approval process before you can start building. This is what Germans discovered. When they ran out of the wind places in the North Germany, basically, they said, okay, we'll put it in the North Sea, right? And there we can put giant turbines and everything, right? But they do not have interconnections like that to North, to South Germany. And the industrial power of Germany is in the middle and the south, right? So they needed this. So they started to build these North-South links, expensive. But then they discovered that even more expensive is to build that link from these 50 kilometers offshore to the shore. Basically, they discovered that the cost of that link from offshore wind farm is about as much as the cost of that wind farm itself, really, right? So then you have to double it, and then you have to build these North-South links in Germany, right? So all of these things are doable. All of these things are possible. There are constant limits running at you, and you may be like last year happens, you know, one day it was very sunny, very nice, and in Germany, by law, you have to buy the solar power, all of it when it's available, by law, right? So during that one noon hour, more than 50% of electricity in Germany came from solar because your gas turbines and because your coal farm have to close down to preferentially buy that solar, right? Only to be restarted later when that sun goes down after 5 p.m., right? So in short period of time, you can achieve some marvelous coverage and amount of green power. But in long run, you have to put in huge, huge reserve to cover for these long windless, cloudless. And we've been mucking with it in the rich countries and in China, because China has lots of, you know, desert place in the West. But look where the future of humanity is. By 2007, more than half of the people began to living in big cities, right? So we are Muslim. In the future, most of the people live in mega cities. Think about energy density. That mega city, if I'm talking about Shanghai or Mumbai or Tokyo, each square meter of that city, average, including the streets and parks, maybe 100 watts per square meter. If I go solar, today is 20, 30 watts per square meter, right? Still, I need somewhere else the area three times or four times that city to gather it, right? If I go wind, which is 1 watt per square meter, I need 100 times the area of that city somewhere to gather that wind, right? If I go biomass, which is 0.5 watts per square meter, as we calculate where I go, right? I need 200, 300 times more area of that city, right? And then I have to bring it to that city, right? Totally new way how to organize our energy system, right? Because now we bring it from 10,000 wells to these cities, right? So if you tell me how decentralized energy with your little wind turbine on your roof and little solar power on your roof will work in 70-story houses in mega cities of the world, then I say welcome to the green world, right? But otherwise, it's a very difficult thing. So this is why I always say what we need is a rational use of energy, not energy conservation. That's a wrong term, right? You know, energy is always conserved after all, right? You know, we don't need energy. If you know your physics, you know, you don't worry about that really. What you worry about is the rational use of energy. And the rational use of energy is not to pour it into a 3-ton car, okay? Notice, almost invariably, maybe Winnipeg is a weird place, but all of the big SUVs are driven by small women, right? Because the number one car is the car which he drives downtown for work, right? And number two car is an SUV which he drives to Safeway, right? You know? So there's a 60-kilogram woman touring in this 3-ton car, right? Okay? That's clearly not a rational use of energy. Now, imagine I'll be fueling this ethanol, this green fuel, right? Does it make any sense, right? You know? The only way you could at least make a half apology for ethanol after all this erosion and nitrogen and, you know, devastation of biodiversity, if you'd be forced to put it into something like which would consume like 100 miles per gallon, right? That would be the only thing. But to pour it into this thing, right, which weighs 3 tons and makes like 11 miles per gallon, right? This is criminal thinking, right? Then we come with LEDs. This is the flavor of the day. Everything is LED. Everything is so efficient, it's unbelievable, right? So people build new houses, and they install so many LEDs outside, more than I have inside now. And they let them on all night, right? Because electricity is so damn cheap in Manitoba, really, right? You know? That's not a rational use of electricity, right? And, of course, these Europeans flying for 20 euro from Amsterdam to Cyprus, that's not a very rational use of electricity, right? One of the most amazing illustrations of this is, remember the big tsunami, right? The Indonesian tsunami, which killed so many people in Thailand. What was the one of the largest, absolutely, you would never think about the classes of people killed? Norwegian babies. Because Norwegian parents flew half around the world to expose their babies to tropical sun, right? And then tsunami killed those Norwegian babies, right? I mean, if you want your son, why not just to fly from Norway to Italy, right? Wouldn't that be enough? It's the same sun, causes the same skin cancer, right? There's no difference there, right? So we, to say that we are wasting energy is not saying anything. Our energy system is grossly irrational, grossly irrational. Best example, of course, I'm writing about this right now, is food. Do you have any idea what is the average percentage of food wasted in US, Canada, and EU? And all that food, don't see food, all that food is energy, right? Harbor synthesis of ammonia, right? Irrigation, right? Pesticides, average pesticides are 150 kilojoules per ton, right? Machinery, tractors, combines, right? Steel, plastics, everything, right? Western countries waste 40% of food they produce, okay? I mean, for what? To achieve massive obesity, unknown in the history of man before, right? That's the result, right? That's the only thing which got out of it, you know? Obesity, unknown in the history of Homo sapiens, right? And still we waste 40% of it, right? So if we'd be rational people, we would be, you know, producing about half as much food as we are producing now. We wouldn't be flying to Cyprus from Amsterdam for 6 hours. We'd be bringing Norwegian babies to Thailand. We wouldn't be driving 3-ton cars. How many people in this class have triple windows? Nobody has triple windows in this room, in your house. Nobody has triple windows. You see the point made, right? This is absolutely criminal. Every person in Canada should have triple windows. Not only triple windows, but triple windows with gas, like I have, with argon, and with reflection. Oh, wow. You see, this is what I'm talking about, right? So you people, so this is basically what Canada, in energy terms, is living pre-Middle Ages, kind of, you know, in darkest times of like, equivalent of Canada energy, like 6th century AD, right? Something like that, you know? Just, you know, before some medieval enlightenment, before they started building some, you know, cloisters in France, you know, and just people that, it's just unbelievable. So we could, again, if I would run the things, I wouldn't want to, right? You know, I'm just like, I'm glad to do my raw garden and my cooking and my books. But if I run the things, I could design a system where we could run Canada on 1/3 of the energy which we are using. And our standard of living would be pretty much the same, except we wouldn't be flying to Thailand, right? You know, and except we wouldn't be driving 3-ton cars, right? And except we wouldn't be building average houses where the number of outdoor lights surpasses the number of indoor lights and are left all night out, right? We'd be charging people for that electricity, right? You know? So I will end on my favorite point in this province, which actually should be the hub and center of it, which is one of the greatest disgrace in history of Canada, which I don't understand. There's a famed company in this city, start with Big B, which is making rapid trains and some planes. Planes are not so good, I think, but maybe the new one will be better, right? New series. But the trains are damn good because these trains are running in foreign places, right? Have you noticed that none of these fast trains is running in Canada? Which country, all the rapid trains are electric trains, right? They're not diesel trains or, you know, whatever, you know, choo-choo coal trains. Which country is the best suited to have rapid electric trains in the world? Well, the country which makes them, this province makes them, the country which is the cheapest hydroelectric in the world. And that's Quebec Hydro and Manitoba Hydro. We have it, right? Instead, I flew today with the most rampant example of not inefficiency, but absolute idiocy. A shuttle every hour from Toronto to Ottawa, from Toronto to Montreal, every hour. Instead of what? What I will do in 2 weeks in Japan. Going downtown in comfort, sitting in a train which will go 300 kilometers per hour, right? Looking out of the window, you know, just working on my computer if I want, looking as the Fuji goes by and beautiful green rice fields, right? And I would make it from Toronto to Montreal, from downtown to downtown in 1 hour and 20 minutes, right? And be done with it, right? We are the last civilized country, except for the US, of course, right? Which is not civilized. We do not have a rapid electricity power train, although we have the cheap hydroelectricity, and also we make those trains. What else can I tell you? This is a primitive country in energy terms. Totally primitive country, right? And what is the worst about it? It's not going to change, right? Now, I realize that we cannot have a rapid train from Toronto to Vancouver, right? There is no population density in between, right? My wife always marvels when we fly from Vancouver to Toronto, from Winnipeg to Toronto. You fly, and for 2 hours you see what? Canadian Shield, right? You know, just forests and lakes, right? So nobody will jump on the train, right? Between Toronto and Winnipeg. Okay, there is Sudbury and whatever, right? But, you know, that doesn't count any. So you have to have a certain population density. But surely we have population density when there is a shuttle every hour, right? And another shuttle going to the Toronto Island now, right? Okay. Train, and this plane gets what? 100, 150 people. Train gets 1,500, 2,000 people, right? Downtown to downtown. Much more convenient, much cleaner, much safer. Everything is superior about it. And we don't even have it. We don't even have a serious discussion about having it. We should have these trains all the way from Chicago to Toronto, from Toronto all the way to probably Quebec City, right? We should have them from Montreal to New York. It would be a civilized, normal country. We would have it. Europeans have it. Chinese have it. Chinese have it now. Chinese have a longer network of these things than anybody else, okay? Even per capita terms, you know, they are not quite like Japanese, but they are catching up. So this is what I mean by rational use of energy. I don't mean conservation. Conservation is more like, you know, I unplug my whatever, toaster, whatever. No, it's the rational use of energy. And this is the prime example of the most irrational use of energy on the planet, you know? At mare usque ad mare, from sea to the sea to the other sea, right? There's nobody as inefficient and lousy as we are. Okay, attack me. Any questions? Show me wrong, what wrong number, whatever. Okay.
Thank you very much. So we have some time for questions, and there are mics on both aisles, so please walk up to the microphone for your questions. First question there, please go ahead.
Yes. Hello, I'm Normand Mousseau. You didn't say a word about the challenge of global warming, which means we have at one point to,
right.
to try
see,
to
no,
attend.
No, I said.
I know, but...
If you use energy more rationally, the problem will almost disappear, because I told you I could design a Canadian system using one third as much energy as we are using now. And that is the solution, rational use of energy.
No, but it's easy in Canada because we use about three times more energy per capita than the other developed countries.
But we don't have to.
No, I know, but the Canada is quite small.
If you have triple windows, you wouldn't have to, right?
I agree, but as you said, the growth at the moment is in China, is in India.
Right.
Where they're still not using so much energy. So the idea of rational use, I mean, you cannot gain that much share.
No, of course, you see, that applies to everything. That applies to food, everything. So, of course, you know, so what I'm saying is I'm outlining the limits of possibility. Lots of the stuff is possible, right? What is likely to happen is a totally different story, right? Facetious reply to this would be saying it's out of our hands. Because suppose we become very rational, right? I did a calculation a few years ago because I got kind of, you know, fed up with that. People attacking the tar sands, right? Of course, they are quote unquote dirty than normal oil. Not by that much, actually. They are not like twice as dirty, right? But, you know, it takes a lot more energy, right? You have to, no matter how you produce them, if you excavate them or if you use the steam assisted recovery, it takes more energy than produce classical crude oil, which, you know, you can pump or flowing from the. So, but I did the calculation, several calculations saying, you know, suppose we save that extra energy, or suppose we will not do any tar sands at all. That was a few years ago when China's energy was still doing this, right? Now it's kind of letting go. So I calculated the Chinese would have made up for it in 17 days, okay? So facetious reply would be basically, we don't matter anymore, really, right? Imagine we close down tar sands in terms of emissions, right, to save these emissions, and Chinese would have caught up global, because it's the globe. See, this is the thing, people have to realize that. Talking about CO2, you shouldn't talk about nations. You have to talk globally. I mean, you know, the gas mixes, right? There is only one CO2 reservoir, and that's the planet, right? Gas may be heavier than the air, but, you know, it's a dynamic mixed atmosphere. So we are 35 million people, so we can become utterly rational, which we won't. But even if we would, really, you know, over the next 20 years, there is another billion people coming in Asia and Africa, right? And they will not become utterly rational because they have to use as much, as fast as they can, whatever they can, really, right? As simple as that. So, as I say, I'm not, you know, saying that to shirk any responsibility, saying, you know, there is nothing we can do. But to a large extent, because this is a global problem, requires global commitment, right? And the only time we have been able to globally pitch was with CFCs, which was a totally different thing, famous Montreal Protocol, and it was easy. Why? Because there were actually only very few makers, right? Few rich countries were making it. And actually, there were only few big makers, you know, Russian state company, DuPont, and the Brits, right? So there are very few, and these people switch from CFCs to HCFCs and make more money on it, right? So there was an easy problem. It didn't require the agreement of 200 countries. It didn't require the subversion of whole industries, right? It required the agreement of few rich countries saying we pay off the poor countries to switch faster, and these companies supplied alternative products, right? So this is not, people say, we've done it with CFCs, we can do this CO2. Totally wrong example, right? Because CO2 is everything. CO2 is, see, any time you want to produce your biofuels by planting more oil palms, you generate CO2 because you cut down the tropical rainforest, right? And the second largest source after burning fossil fuels, what? Cutting down the tropical rainforest, right? No? So this is only global solution. And in many countries, I'm not saying we shouldn't do anything, right? But in many countries, let's say Denmark, all these European countries, 4 million people, a country like a county town in China, right? 4 million people, right? They could totally give up fossil fuels, right? It will be made up by Indians and Chinese in a matter of hours or days, right? So this is a problem which is not so much a technical problem, not so much an engineering problem. It is a problem of, us saying, well, these people have to come up because they will come up no matter what, right? And for them to come up and keep it whatever to 450 more, we will not keep it. We are way over 400 ppm already now. We are not way over, but we are. So we will not keep it, but say 500. Even to keep it to 500 ppm CO2, really, right, we will have to come down. Because they will come up regardless, right? Are you willing to come down? That's the question. Are you willing to come down? Really? Are you willing to, consume one-third, 40% of energy? So this is not a problem. It's not a technical problem, really, because it doesn't have any technical solution. Because the technical solution would be what? Oh, yeah, capture of CO2 from the air. Please study carefully the chemistry and study carefully the amount you would have to remove, right? For it to make any difference, right, you would have to remove what? About 10 billion tons every year, right, to begin with, right? Or capture and sequester it down, right? I used to give this example. What we take out of the ground in terms of oil, right, it's about 4 billion tons, right? If you put 4 billion tons of CO2 down there, just reversing the process, right, of oil production, right, what is it? We generate now more than 30 billion tons, right? So this is like 15%, not even so, right? So again, the scale defeats us. We've become so big in energy terms, right, that there is no simple engineering solution because of the scale. So forget about the capture from the air, forget about the storage underground. That cannot work, really, right? So the only thing which can work, really, is to consume less. And to consume less on a global scale is they will come up, as I say, they will not ask us for permission, right? India said, famous Paris Agreement, whatever. And he said, no, we'll burn as much as we can, right? And did you notice what China said, right? Oh, that's a beautiful formulation. We promise to peak before 2030. Huh? What does that mean, right? Peak at what level, right? Okay? So, as I say, they'll get it no matter what we'll say or do, really, right? So, to keep it globally below whatever, 500 people, whatever, we have to come down, really. Okay, so the onus is on us because it's very difficult to tell them, China is about 90 gigajoules per capita, primary energy. We are 360, okay, four times as much, right? So Chinese, and moreover, Chinese raise this argument, Chinese don't say, in per capita terms, you are four times as much. No, Chinese will say what? In per capita terms, and cumulatively over the past 150 years, you are about 50 times as much, right? Okay? Because Chinese went to 90 gigajoules only like yesterday, right? Because under Mao, until 1976, they were like 15 gigajoules, right? So Chinese say, per capita, in historical accumulation terms, right, we still can go like 200 times more than we are going right now. Right? And you have no moral argument to say no to them, right? Because we have done it already, right? So they're just trying to do that, right? So this is basically a moral problem, it's a behavioral problem, it's not a technical problem, because there is no technical solution to it. Not on a time scale required, right? Not in the next 30, 40, 50 years, right? If you want to keep it below 500 ppm or whatever, right? Also, we don't know, right? God knows, right? This is an evolving knowledge, right? Maybe 500 ppm will not be that bad. Maybe 500 ppm will be catastrophic. We have no idea. As I said, we are not very good at getting these, truly long-term forecasts. Right? Don't forget, all of these are just models, right? It's just modeling is one thing and reality is another, right? So.
Perhaps, yeah, we'll take a question over here now.
You've presented us with a rather interesting paradox. You're suggesting the solution to our energy problems is not technical, but obviously it's political and economic. But those very same political and economic forces are pushing the technical argument because it's easier for them to do so than it is to change the system. So how are we going to change this system in the direction that you think we ought to go?
No, so you see, I should have been more careful. I should have said the solutions are not primarily technical. Of course, everything is technical. This society is just suffused with la technique. Everything, right? Everything is, you know, so to do anything without mucking with the current arrangement, current technology, is impossible. Right? So, you know, let me qualify the statement. I would say primarily not, because even when we could get the most efficient things, suppose, you know, we have what we have. Suppose the whole world is using only the most efficient electric motors, internal combustion engine, gas turbines, everything is most efficient as is, right? Well, that would still save us probably, you know. We see, we are having slow margins now. Let me give you some examples to impress on people how we do not have that much room. I have in my basement a furnace, gas furnace, which is 97% efficient. How much far can I go, really, right? I mean, you know, I don't have any chimney anymore. You know, it's 97%. Even so-called mid-efficiency furnace, which is now required by building codes in Canada, is what? About 78% efficient, right? So we cannot double the efficiency of the furnace. So I go from 78 to 97, right? Everybody gets that, right? Okay, you know, so this is not marginal, but I'm getting what, you know, 10, 15, 20% is most of these things, right? I go from the best engine to the average engine. Again, you know, I get something like that, right? I go from the best plane. Suppose, you know, you eliminate all the other planes and you just fly 787. Well, you save 15%, right? Or 18%, whatever, right? So the best, suppose we get all the old-fashioned stuff out of the system and globally we use only the most efficient energy converters we have. Saves us about 15, 20, 25%, right? Given the population growth, we are 7.3 billion, we'll be 9 billion in the next 30 years, right, 40 years. That's not going to solve the problem, really, right? And it's not only the growth, these are the people who expect to consume more. Because if China was at 15 on the Mao, and now it's 90 kilograms per ton, India is still 15 now or 20, right? And they want to go to 90. So it's the population growth plus the increased consumption, right? So the technical solution, as important as it is, cannot hack it alone. It's not a primary solution.
I know, but we're still stuck with the problem of how do you convince people to make more intelligent use of energy?
Oh, people
how
always
are you going to do that?
There is no secret to it. Hit them in their pocket. Make them pay. It's very simple as that, really. Look, you know, okay, let's see if somebody knows this. What do you think a typical, you know, this non-existent, mythical American middle-class family, which every politician refers to. What is the typical average middle-class family? How much of their disposable income, not gross earnings, how much of their disposable income they pay for energy? What percentage? 9%. 9%. And another 9% they pay for food, the most essential energy of all, right? So your average American and Canadian family pay less than 20% for essential energies, light, heat, motion, food. Rest of it is the mortgages on the houses which they cannot afford and junk made in China, right? Okay, that's the way, okay? Ephemeral stuff to be thrown away, all these plastic doodads and everything, right? Now, when I was growing up in Europe as a young boy, how much did we pay for food? Some of the wider people will remember because, you know, some of them, well, in Europe after the war, it was 60%. Don't forget, even in England, food was rationed until 1954, even in England, right? So 50-60% of disposable income for food, that was normal. In China, under Mao, was 50%, right? In most poor countries, it's 40-60% still, really, right? In Europe, it's still 20%, not 9 as here. In Switzerland, it's still like 22%. It's still 20% in Europe, right? So this is what we need. So the only way not to waste that much and only way to, you know, you use things more rationally is to pay more for it. You will be more careful. Not everybody, right? Some people are zillionaires, but most people are more careful. And so we just basically, we are giving away electricity. We are giving away gasoline in North America. We are basically giving everything away. We are giving away food, right? It's absolutely amazing, right? If you think of, let's say, of animals, right? How much energy you have to spend because animal, warm-blooded animal like a pig, or even more than cow, right? Most of the energy you feed them for the time when they are growing goes into what? Having them running and, you know, keeping the body temperature, right? So you have to use, even for a pig, 7 units of feed to produce 1 unit of meat, right? For for cows which are fed in these big fenced Texas arrangements, it's up to 1 to 20, right? And then you waste at the end of it 40% of it, really, right? No? So, because what? I shop several times a week, so I was so busy or whatever, and they had a sale on pork. 1.5 kilo of pork for $7. For $7, you know. If our energy would be that cheap, you just couldn't produce it. So everything, this is you have to realize, every price we pay in North America, no price reflects the cost of production in energy terms, right? No price. If you'd pay the real cost reflecting the embodied cost of energy in your sweater or in your shoes or in your steak or in your red peppers, right? We'd be paying for everything 2 times or 3 times as much, and food would cost whatever, you know, 30% of disposable income. So that's the only way to go. If you are giving it away, people will waste it. As simple as that. There is no other way. Some people will still waste, right? Because some people have ostentatious consumption, but most people will manage, right? So please, you know, I know people constantly complain, you know, price of gas is expensive, whatever. But no, you know, this is the we are living in a society which is the cheapest food and energy prices in history of mankind. Period. That's a statement of absolute fact, right? From now on, it will get only worse, right? We could make it worse by design, not to waste so much, but it will get worse on its own. Be sure, right? Because the state of the world ecosystem is not very good, right? And the state of the world ecosystem determines the production of the most important energy in the world, which is food, really. Most important energy is not electricity or gasoline, it's food. And our food production, if you look at a historical long-term side, we used to have these yields, you know. Comes the Green Revolution of 60s, and yields go up, 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 up. What have been the most of the yields of rice, corn, wheat been doing in the past 20 years? Flattened. They are not going up, up, up anymore, really, right? And if they'll go up, 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 we need more inputs. We need more irrigation, right? Especially with droughts. We need more fertilizer. And if not, we need some massive genetic interventions, but we are not at that point yet. This is our great hope, you know, that most of our plant we can eventually solve by synthetic genomics. But we are not there yet, really, right? Because once you really master synthetic genomics, you can have your bacteria spitting your gasoline, right? And you can other bacteria spitting your whatever, you know, hamburger meat, so to speak, right? But we are not there quite yet, despite of the CRISPR cutting and everything, you know, it's a while, you know. It's like all these men. These men appear in this this university does it. Everybody does it. This man appears behind that long desk in the white coats and say, we've just invented another cure for cancer, but it will not be available for next 20 years, right? So the same is CRISPR cutting of genes and everything. Yeah? Not so fast, right? So we will not have... Remember the guy who started the game, Venter, right? He said, you know, I will give you the bacteria which will be spitting gasoline, right? Yesterday. Well, 10 years later, we still don't have them, right? So it is a possibility. And for me, speaking as a biologist, this is the greatest hope for the future, right? That we will engineer everything, which means also we will engineer people. And that will not be so nice, right? You know, just because you see, we won't stop at engineering gasoline spitting bacteria, right? We'll start engineering people on a big scale, right? So that may be a scary, but this may be much worse than living in a world with energy scarcity, but normal people, right? So.
So next question here.
Well, thank you so much for your presentation. I'd just like to reiterate a lot of what we're all feeling, in that you sort of opened our minds to a lot of the different perspectives on global energy problems. I wouldn't mind hearing your perspective more on something a little more specific.
I spoke about Canada, don't forget, the most primitive energy country in the world.
That's right. Okay. So I was hoping to hear something on a little more of a smaller topic, in particular nuclear. You alluded to it slightly at the beginning in sort of making note of France and how France changed. I was wondering if you could sort of give a little discourse on that change, as well as what your thoughts are for nuclear in the future, mostly because it's such a dormant and controversial topic, and yet it has so much promise. But I was in particular wondering what your thoughts were on this issue.
Okay, if I would be flippant, I would say, you know, why are we talking about nuclear energy? It's dead. Now, this statement requires qualification, right? It's dead in the sense, how many nuclear power plants have you built in this country in the past 25 years? Zero, right? How many power plants, the country which is the largest, there's about 438 of them now, whatever, roughly like, let's say 440 nuclear plants around the world. Of them, about 100 is in the US, right? All of them are aging now, right? All of them were built in 60s, 70s, early 80s, they're all aging. to replace the current plants, right? We would, should be building like 50 of them. How many are building? 2.5 or 3.5, depends how you count it, right? How many are building in Europe? 2, right? The one which used to be the shining light, the big Finnish one, right? Which used to be finished on time and on money. It's now what? Nearly twice as much time and more than twice as much money, right? The country which derives 30% of nuclear electricity from nuclear, Japan, right? I don't have to say any more, post-Fukushima, right? Japan will never, ever derive 30% of nuclear electricity from nuclear. So the West, EU, North America, Japan, is not building. Who is building? Yeah, do you really want these people to keep on building? I give you the list of the people who are building. North Korea, South Korea, China, and Iran. Huh? And India a little bit, right? Imagine an accident happening in one of these countries, right? In China, Fukushima, that's what you call Tohoku, the northern Japan, which is lightly populated, relatively poor. You evacuate 100,000 people, you are done with it, right? In China, similar accident will affect 100 million people, right? Given the density. All these plants in China, they are not somewhere in the boondocks of Tibet, right? There is no juice line. They are in populated areas in East China. They are in the suburbs of Shanghai, in Zhejiang province, right? In China, they are there, you know? So imagine a Fukushima-style accident in China, right? It's only a matter of time. It's extremely volcanically active place, right? One of the worst earthquakes of the 20th century was just when Mao died in September 1976 in Tangshan, less than 50 kilometers from Beijing. 700,000 people died, okay? This is extremely active place, right? So imagine, I don't have to tell you anything about North Korea nuclear weapons, right? They are building, they just announced a new reactor running, great, right? South Korea, well, South Korea may be nice and cuddly and friendly, but it's within the range of everything which North Korea can throw at it, including their nuclear power plants, right? So do I want the South Korea to build? They have one of the biggest programs, right? And then is India, right? Is it stable? Well, there is a Pakistan next door, right? So how stable it can be, really, right? You know. So do I want this quartet of people to, and there is Iran, really. Do I want these people? So these are the only builders today. So much about the state of nuclear, and Russians are kind of building, right? But that's pretty much the same story. After all, these are the creators of Chernobyl reactor, right? So, you know, which didn't even have a containment building, right? That's speaking about engineering, right? You just build a reactor, and you let the guys to play with it at 4 a.m. or 3 a.m., really, kind of, you know, just playing with it, right? You know, this is how Chernobyl accident happened, really, right? And when it happened, it wasn't even a containment building. At least we are not that dumb that at least we had an accident in Three Miles Island, right? And everything remained within the concrete building, really, right? Nothing escaped, really, right? So do I want these five people to build? No, but they are building. We are not really. So much. Years ago, I was thinking about these things, saying, you know, what should I say about nuclear power? And I came up with, oh, it's trite, it's simple, it's primitive, but nevertheless, I'm proud of it because, you know, in two words, it encapsulates nuclear electricity. It's been a successful failure, right? Successful because we are getting more electricity out of it than hydro, more than all these new renewables, right? It's the single biggest chunk after thermal electricity from coal and oil, really. So it's been successful. Japan, 30%, France, 70%, right? But it's been a failure because we are not building anymore, and we washed our hands of it, and we walked away from it, and we left it to Koreans and Iranians, right? You know, so much about nuclear. As you see, I'm a friend of nuclear electricity. I have nothing against nuclear electricity, right? If you do it right, you know, you can do it right. French have done it right, right? You can do it right. Also, even French haven't solved the ultimate NIMBY problem. Where do you put the long-lived waste, right? Nobody has a long-lived depository. Russians don't have it, Chinese don't have it, Americans don't have it, Japanese don't have it. Nobody has it, right? So that's another thing. But so far, as I say, successful failure. It has been, you know, it's done lots of good, but future of it is questionable, and the cost of it is mind-boggling, especially these days when you can get a barrel of oil for $40, you know, to build something for $3 billion to get you 1 gigawatt, really. This is not such a kind of, you know, enticing proposition. So I don't see anybody building anything anytime soon. After all, even the mother of this all, La France itself, says what? We are not going to build anymore. In fact, we will reduce, really, right? So if the France, the ultimate dirigeant nuclear power, says no more, then it's over for power, nuclear power in the Western world, right? It was the only shining light, right? Look at the Flamanville, and, you know, it's not a pretty story. Nuclear power is a story of, you know, as I say, it's been successful, but it's been beyond disappointing, actually. And in my historical work, I look at these things, you know, that there is this forecast, General Electric. It's not like, you know, some kind of, you know, little dinky forecast, but General Electric, big internal publication in 74. I have the original copy. Said by year 2000, there will be no thermal power plants, no coal, oil, natural gas. Everything will be nuclear. Not only that, 80% will be fast breeder reactor. I mean, there is not a single fast breeder reactor working anywhere in the Western world. We all have them. We all finance them. You know, we have them in Japan. We have them in France. We have them in United States. All shut down, right? That was to be the future of nuclear power. So, you know, it's nothing to do with liking or not liking nuclear power, but the facts on the ground are it's just not moving ahead. It's not happening, right? You know?
Last question there.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
I want to congratulate you for coming to the McGill Faculty of Engineering and telling the Emperor that that he doesn't have any clothes.
Well, there are some clothes, but they are skimpy, right?
They're skimpy clothes, that's right. The Emperor is poorly clad. And so if innovation is not the answer, or is not entirely the answer, then what are we all doing here studying engineering with bright futures in our minds? And how close is the human race to Icarus, and should we be
so
looking...
So you say the last one, how close to what?
The human race to the hubris of our collective ego. Are we headed towards catastrophe? Are climate scientists telling us inflated lies? What gives you hope, I suppose, is my question.
You see, very long-term historical perspective... we never know. Things usually we worry about, I mean, it's not an ironclad rule, but it's a pretty good rule. Things we worry about, usually kind of, you know, they get solved, but things we which don't worry about catch us. And when you look historically, this, you know, in past 25 years, you ask what's hopeful. Many things are. One of the most absolutely unbelievable things, speaking as the former citizen of the evil empire, is the peaceful collapse of the USSR. These people had 11,000 nuclear warheads, really, right? And they just went home like one Sunday, they just went home. That's it, really, right? They've given the empire, right? You know, just like that, okay? There'll be a little skirmish in Ukraine and, you know, the result was Chechnya. And, you know, it's not all pretty, but this is absolutely unbelievable, right? You know, it's like, you know, that's it, really. China is a different story because Chinese people have benefited tremendously from after Mao's death with this... turn to more or less real economy and, you know, having enough to eat, whatever. But otherwise, China, of course, is run as deeply and strongly by Communist Party as it ever was. Just check the number of people which they employ to censor internet, right? Just check the number. I will not tell you the number again. Check it for yourself. It's just absolutely amazing the power of one political party, how many people can employ just to censor. People are sending each other messages. Yet, you know, they feel obliged to censor that, really, right? So China is much less of a hopeful story. They have enough to eat, and they will now all travel to see Arc de Triomphe, really, right? But otherwise, you know, it's not such a triumphal story, really, right? But Russia is, despite this problem, because, you know, this was the seeds of the World War III, really, right? And, you know, it didn't happen, not going to happen. So that was very interesting. The fact that we have been able... despite of these many prophecies, how everything will end up terribly. 2005, that was the peak here of the peak oil. I got so fed up with it that I wrote this article saying, you know, this is utter nonsense. There is so much oil in the world, really. There's no, okay? Now, of course, you know, people realize. Now people say, there is too much oil, right? There's too low price. Isn't that funny, right? People were telling us in 2005, peak oil, immediately, we are running out. It's the end of the world. And they say, oh, we should worry about low energy prices. We need a higher energy price, right? You know, just in 10 years, right? So we worried mightily about running out of everything, right? Are we running out of anything? No, in terms of mineral stuff, we are not running out of anything, right? With this fracking now, we have probably natural gas in US and Canada for the next 100 years for nominal low prices because we are getting better. This is where the engineers have the role to play, right? When we started to frack, right, we use this much water. and that much sand and inefficient. Now we are getting smarter. How do you keep those pores open, right? Because when you, not pores, these interstices places, when you force it open by the high water pressure, right, you have to keep it open, right? So we are now pouring a lot more sand, right, to keep it open, really. So our yield per well is increasing, right? Cost is coming down, right? Sand is cheaper, right? You know? So this is what the, where the Saudis somewhat miscalculated. In long run, Saudis will be right, you know. In long run, people in Bakken or Eagle Ford shale, they cannot produce for $5 a barrel, right? But they said $60 will kill them, $50 will kill them, $40. No, probably some of them will produce at $25, right? Because this is the learning, this is the engineering process. But it has a limit, right? They cannot produce like in Saudi Arabia, you know, these oil fields, you drill the hole and you produce for 25 cents, basically. So you cannot do that, right? You know, but so you see, so we basically, we lay to the rest this this big, you know, terrifying dragon of running out of everything, right? But we are running out of something which we don't talk about nearly as much as we talk about peak oil. In 2005, everything was peak oil, you know, everything special. There is a peak water. Many places are running out of water very seriously, including large parts of China, large parts of India. I know, I don't know if you've seen the paper in Nature a few years ago, it was just absolutely marvelous paper. We can see from satellites, because these satellites, you know, we can down we can down literally, you know, to a few millimeters. We can see how the North China Plain and Gangetic Plain, how it's really sinking because of the sucking water from the underground water, right? So you can see from satellites that the ground, you know, you can see. So this is a very simple, because there'll be another 500 million people. In fact, the latest projections are that India will surpass China about 15 years earlier than we thought, right? Which was about 2050. Now we think about 2035. India will be number one world population, right? And they already are sucking the Gangetic Plain dry, right? So if I would worry about something, really, you know, I wouldn't worry about oil or bauxite or whatever, right? You know, I would worry about water in large parts of the world, including China, India, and including large parts of Europe. I don't know if you realize it, but large parts of, including Germany, Poland, are very dry countries, actually. You know, they rely mostly on river water and whatever. So this is my serious worry. So we've been able to rise to this resource challenge by technical innovation. We've been able to overcome some of these big political challenges. You know, China after Mao could have ended up like, you know, Syria after Assad, right? I mean, you know, the potential was there. Russia after USSR. So it's very difficult where it will come from. If you would ask me what I worry about besides water, do you people realize that we are still printing in the U.S. $1 trillion a year? Literally printing paper money, $1 trillion. This is how we solve our economic problem. Can it go forever? Well, of course it cannot, really, right? The so-called economy is just totally, this is just Fata Morgana, totally, really, right? You know, just, it's called quantitative easing. Oh my God, what an Orwellian super newspeak, right? You know, you just print, you don't create any value, you just print $1 trillion, right? You know? And what are interest rates? Fundamentally zero, right? So people can go and borrow the money for the biggest house they cannot afford because it costs them nothing, really, right? You know? So I worry, eventually the fundamentals of the economy, there is no such science as economics, it's all, you know, it's in your head anyway, right? But there are some physical fundamentals underlying it eventually, right, you know, and it will have to catch up with us. So I think about the state of the global economy, which is totally ridiculous, both in China or in US, these big powers, and EU, and think of that EU, 25% of your age are unemployed, right? 18 to 25, 25% unemployed. I mean, can it go on forever without some social unrest or something will give eventually, right? You know. So I worry about the social conditions of the Western world. I worry about the state of the Western economy or Eastern economy. I worry about the state of water. Look at California. California drought last time, it's not unprecedented, but last time they had such a drought was what? We can read the tree rings, right? From trees, very reliable, right? 1,200 years ago. That was the last time, right? How many people lived in California 1,200 years ago, right? About 10,000 of Indians, right? Gathering whatever, the acorns, and right? And hunting some deer, right? Now, if it'll be the state alone, it will be what? Seventh largest economy in the world, right? And it hasn't rained there. Just check the drought map of California. It's not drought. It's not severe drought. It's not There is one more category. They have to create another category. It's called exceptional drought, right? It's not serious. It's not severe. It's exceptional. And about like, now I got a little better on the margin, but still this exceptional drought. Right? Basically, and what is most important, there is no snowpack left on Sierras. So there is nothing to feed. So in the seventh largest economy in the world, or whatever it is now, I would worry about that, right? So, and again, of course, I was there 10 days ago, and what? People are still watering the lawns. Going to your question, right? If these people who have to pay $1,000 per drop of water, nobody watering anything, really, right? But, you know, it's still cheap. People are watering lawns, you know, just like that, right? You know, Stanford University is just watering lawns at 11 a.m., at the time of the highest evapotranspiration. Haven't these people taken a course in basic biology, really, right? You know, if they are so stupid, cannot they water at least at 4 a.m., really, instead of watering at 11 a.m., really, right? You know? Okay, and they told me, oh, no, that's no problem. It's from lagoon, right? Well, it's the water, it's the total water, so that lagoon will be gone when they water, and there'll be nothing left then, right? You know, it's just, so this makes it good, really. I still have my little private reserve of water, and I use it to water my lawn, really, right? You know, it's from the lagoon, because alumni want to see the lawns green when they come back to Stanford, really. And alumni give $1 billion in endowment, right? So you have to keep the lawns green, right? So, you know, to make a long story short, I don't know what I should worry about, because what really catches us in the long run is something which we cannot foretell. One thing which gives me the greatest hope is that we are living so much beyond our means, wasting 40% of food, wasting whatever, that we could, in times of toughness, we could, you know, shelter, go down, scrounge, you know, go into the shell, and we can survive with much less, you know, it will not be so pretty, right? No flights to Amsterdam over weekend, whatever, but we can. So this gives me the hope, you know, that the margin of the waste and irrationality is so big that we can pull back, right, and do something like, as I always tell people, right, you know, because I'm an old man, so I have this perspective. Was the life so unbearable? Let's say, then I'll tell people, let's say, let's use half as much energy as we are using now, half as much. Was the life so unbearable in Bordeaux in 1960? And they use half as much energy as we are using now, right? Okay? Was the life so unbearable, you know, in Tokyo in 1975? Yeah. So,
lives, you mean.
Sorry?
Like
that is what?
I have no idea what that was.
So you see, we can to answer the question about hope, we could pull back quite substantially to the level where we were, let's say, 1960s, when people think that we doubled our energy like over past 200 years. No, we doubled it since 1960s in most of the Western countries, right? Most of the people, I was studying beautiful French historical statistics. By late 1950s, most of the French families didn't have an indoor toilet and indoor bathroom, right? That all came in early 1960s for most of the French people, right? So most of them didn't have a car, most of them didn't have a refrigerator. So our riches are very recently, and most of the people didn't fly over the weekend anywhere until the 1980s or whatever, right? So this is what gives me hope, really, that we are living so much beyond our means, that we can pull back and still live nice, productive life without wasting as much as we do. Right?
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Smith. So that was a very sort of thought-provoking evening, and thank you again very much. I'd like to thank all of you for coming on behalf of Fondacion 3E, Tysed, and McGill. And please do keep in touch with Tysed, and please look up our website for future events which are coming up, I guess, in a week or so. Thank you all. Bye.